Hi, my name is Jamie Mackay and I head the Postgraduate Learning and Teaching Programmes at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. And this podcast is part of a series where I ask established arts educators about their practice. In this podcast episode, I'm delighted to be talking to Eric Booth. Eric has been described as the father of the teaching artist profession, one of the 50 most important US arts leaders, one of America's most creative teachers and best teachers of creativity, one of the 25 most important people in American arts education, and an essential leader in the US World El Sistema movement. In his illustrious career, he has been a successful Broadway actor, businessman, author, educator, and consultant, and he is a founder of the International Teaching Artist Collaborative. So, could you introduce yourself and say a little about your current role as an arts educator?
My name is Eric Booth, and I am the oldest living teaching artist. After 45, whatever years of never really having had a job, but working in the interstitial places where arts learning happens, never being a full-time teacher in a conservatory or a school, although I did start the teaching artist program at Juilliard. So I took the deep dive into the mothership of, you know, traditional preparation. And I've worked for many years in community arts settings. So I know art with a small A as well. And a lot of my decades of work has been creating programs that try to honor the in-between place.
That's a great term. Thank you. So when you're working with learners, what is your goal?
Well, it's the teaching artist credo, which is the number one job of a teaching artist is to activate the artistry of other people. The number one job of an artist is to make worlds, to make these beautiful, coherent, rich nouns of art and present them in the most engaging possible ways for people to come on inside and find out what's in there. The number one job of a teaching artist is to tap the universal artistic capacities in all people they get to work with. And once that gigantic force has been loosed, it can be channeled into any number of different purposes, one of which is it can be channeled into enhanced encounters in works of art. So when you can wake up someone's artistry, one of the things that power can do is help them find their own way inside artworks and make meaning. So I think of teaching artistry as an expansion of the artist's opportunity, not a separate little kit bag of teaching artist tools that you open up when circumstances provide, but actually the same mission as an artist, just expanded.
Great. Thank you. What barriers get in the way of achieving that goal then?
Well, the barriers that get in the way of that are enormous. Otherwise, everyone would have heard about teaching artists instead of so few people having heard about teaching artists. And there's a couple of primary barriers. Certainly one of them is all the money, all the tradition, all the understanding falls into the great river of high arts traditions. The public monies, the philanthropic monies, they want the ballet companies and the symphonies, and then they get a little bit wild with new music or, you know, modern art and around the edges. I refer to all of that as the art club. And God love it. I'm glad the art club is around. I'm glad people still love it. It has huge rewards. But as I read the research, only about 6% of people in the US and the UK actually think of themselves as members of the art club. They may go to an arts thing, but identifying as a person who loves the arts That's 6% of our bloody public. That's 94% who are, if not structurally, at least emotionally not included. The teaching artist's work is about opening up the power of the arts to that other 94%. And I must say, the way the high arts are heading, this industry sure needs teaching artists, because that is not a business model for sustainability. And teaching artists know how to wake up the relevance and the interest of a lot of that high arts world. They also can channel that innate artistry that everyone has into a whole lot of other channels, like increased achievement in schools, into making communities more livable, and in a lot of the work I've been doing recently, into addressing the climate crisis. We've got this code red crisis, and the high arts, they can create a concerto that's got whale sounds in it, but you put a teaching artist on the ground in a community and you change beliefs and behaviors that directly affect the climate crisis.
So what strategies then do you use to achieve your goal and deal with these barriers?
Both I and the many tens of thousands of teaching artists around the world have to be flexible to adapt to the opportunities we can create. In the U.S., my own background, I was trained for the high arts until I found out I didn't like it very much. I was a Broadway actor and doing shows all the time, but doing shows 8 times a week and then rushing off to do peanut butter commercials didn't seem like what the game I wanted to get into, until I discovered where most U.S. teaching artistry began, which is in schools, how much more interesting it was to engage with people who weren't already in the enabling constraints of the high arts, but could actually make stuff they cared about and then remake it and come up with completely original expression. So much of my early work was in and around schools, learning both how to provoke more effective learning and then how to extend it so that it can actually step out of my background of theater and enhance their learning in history, and then enhance their wish to engage in community. That's what it can do. So depending on the projects I can create or the programs I get to work with, I'll work with businesses one day to enhance the creativity and innovative capacity of their employees. The next week, I might be working on a community mural to address a racial issue that's hot in that city. And the day after that, working with 10-year-olds on expanding the way they can describe their sense of the future. So there's this flexibility in the way teaching artists work, with a core set of practices, but infinite flexibility in the activities we create.
And how do you measure your success then as an arts educator?
Oh, you ask a poignant question. For a good 30 years of my teaching artist career, we really ducked that. We just went with, oh, you should have seen the smiling faces. And our funders in the U.S., and bear in mind, in the U.S., we don't have much government funding, so it's mostly private funders. They really only cared if we were touching X number of little heads. That was sufficient and evidence of impact. And it also was, under this guise that we're building future audiences, even though there wasn't one scintilla of evidence that teaching artists going into a school actually made a kid who wasn't from a background that loved the arts, turned him into an arts lover. So we ducked your question for a good 30 years until funders started to say, hey, wait a minute. It happened in the UK a little more gently, but in the US, it's blunt because it's private money. So we began to have to develop our own assessment methodologies for impact. There's a particular teaching artist friendly methodology that we've been relying on in ITAC, the International Teaching Artist Collaborative. It's called, if any of your listeners want to check it out, I recommend it. It's called the Continuum of Impact, published by Animating Democracy. And it shows a range, a continuum of kinds of impact the work can have, and recommends really commonsensical tools for determining, have you changed the way people think? Have you changed the way they behave? Have you actually affected a system? And now, if you know we have enough money to fund a longer term project, we want to see effect on a system. We don't want to just see people having different kinds of conversations. So the assessment challenge has risen really to the front burner of this field, especially as we're starting to get taken a little more seriously by non-arts institutions, as governments start to bring in teaching artists in residence to help them achieve results. They want to see results. They want to count it. And one beautiful example I have to praise because it comes from Scotland and it's one of the most outstanding examples in the world is the research done by Systema Scotland, Big Noise, their periodic research studies, mostly in Govanhill in Glasgow, but in other communities as well, including unassailable research about what's called the opportunity cost, which shows for every dollar invested in this youth music program, how many dollars of public savings there is in social service expenses. And over 15 years, it's something like £26 million are saved by investing in these music programs in a much smaller amount. So we're beginning to grow up and become responsible adults about assessment, even though it's a difficult challenge. We've recognized smiling faces and happy kitties was really not going to change the status quo until we really grew into our entelechy to back up our claims of impact.
How would you describe the ideal relationship between you and a learner?
It's a good teaching artist question. The ideal relationship is co-learner, co-explorer. There is a rule I impose on all poor teaching artists who come within my reach, which is called the law of 80%. And I call it a law to make it sound scary. And the statistic 80% creates the false impression that I've done some research. In fact, it is an approximate statement that 80% of what you teach is actually who you are. 80% of your impact on a learner is your being your most distilled artist self in relation to another human you see as an artist. That is the relationship where they are drinking in what it means to listen like an artist, what it means to see somebody spark ideas with what's actually happening. You see the sort of beginnings of making stuff you care about, and this sort of collegial respect for creative capacity in the other one. That is more than catnip. That is pure protein for the spirit. So I find, although I'm sometimes pushed into situations where I'm expected to instruct, and I do a whole lot of keynote speeches where I'm expected to declaim, I never undertake any of those without a participatory activity involved that puts us in a co-learning situation where we're discovering something together and actually getting the visceral feel of the verbs of art and not just admiring the nouns of art, including a nifty keynote speech where I say all kinds of clever things. It has more impact that moment when I got them to notice they just engaged in a creative process that was different than the person sitting next to them. They're learning more about art in that moment than in all my nifty slogans.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll come back to some of that later. This is, in your case, I think a redundant question. What job title are you most comfortable with?
I used to say I should print a business card with the title Agent of Artistic Experience. That's actually the most accurate job title. It's never going to fly. It's an awkward sounding phrase, but that's actually it. To be the representative of artistic experience and be the catalyst to make it happen in as many people and as many places as possible. I'll settle for teaching artist because it's a little handier, although it's a problematic term in and of itself, in that the artists who work in schools and communities around the world use a whole bunch of different titles, of which teaching artist is only one. But I don't think anyone but me identifies as an agent of artistic experience.
Excellent. Thank you. What three values are central to your practice as an arts educator?
Three values. One is a respect to the point of reverence for the universality of creative capacity. And I will give you an example in a minute, if you want, at its absolute extreme. That's one value. Another is the ruthless use of fun, that in fact, all humans, and in fact, all living things function on the pleasure principle. They move toward that which is pleasurable and move away from that which is not. So bringing people into artistic experience in a way that is both authentically aesthetic and provides discovery of new pleasurable experiences, new discoveries, new insights, the reliance on pleasure as a tool. I mean, in a way, Freud was right. The pleasure principle is what drives behavior. And so I'm always guiding teaching artists to find the pleasure in the work, even in things we don't think of as necessarily pleasurable, like reflection. And that leads me to my third truth, which comes from the philosopher John Dewey, who said, a great favorite of mine, if we do not reflect on our experiences, we do not learn from them. That's simple. And the times we live in are belligerently anti-reflective. So a major value for me is the remedial work of bringing people back into the pleasures and curiosities and interests of reflective experience so they can unpack rather than consume. The consumption training that we get in our conditioned world actually squelches the very thing that helps people learn with pleasure. And so I think it's incumbent upon artists who really want to develop audiences and artistry to devise ranges of ways to make it delicious to reflect on experiences, to reflect on processes, so that it builds a habit of mind of curiosity about that which is usually squelched in a hyper-commercial society.
You said you might expand on this, your first example of respect.
Yes. Here's the most spectacular demonstration of teaching artistry I ever saw was many years ago. It was in a kind of a rundown classroom in Indianapolis, Indiana. Six young people were brought in for this music teaching artist to work with for an hour. And his assignment was, they had never worked together, and he was to get them to make music together in 1 hour. And all six were both deaf and blind. So I sat there as he was getting started and thinking, how the hell do you approach this challenge? How do you respect the natural artistry of people that you can't even connect with in all the tools I'm used to using? And I watched in 1 hour this guy wake them up to the discovery of discovering rhythmic sounds they could pick up in their bodies through hitting drums, getting them to partner, getting them to play in unison, and then getting them to improvise together, riffing off one another, all within in 1 hour from feeling vibrations on their bodies for the first time. It was a kind of ecstasy for them to be making a connection this deep. And when the hour was over, I walked out of the room with this teaching artist, and he like popped one of these like stupid little brim up hats on his head. And he was just kind of walking out like he'd had a pretty good class with a bunch of musicians. The amount of respect for he had for the innate musical capacity in people I would not have thought possible. And he tapped it elegantly, playfully, joyfully in 1 hour. That's the bet. To me, that's what teaching artistry at its best can do.
That's excellent. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to switch the question slightly. If you could have a mentor from any time in history, real or fictional, to support your arts education practice, who would you choose?
It's a poignant question because I never had a mentor. It just didn't work out for me. You know, I had a few good teachers. I had many okay teachers. I have started at least 4 mentoring programs for other people to generate the kind of mentor relationship I never had. So to be invited to think of a mentor, the one that springs to mind, an area that I wished I'd had a deep dive in, is Augusto Boal, the Theater for Social Development and Theater of the Oppressed. And I wished I could have been by his side, how much I would have valued his perspective on the kinds of ideas and activities I've invented, but kind of had to try out on my own and see if others worked. But to really have been guided by so much wisdom and commitment would have been a real gift to my life.
So if you could ask him one question, what would it be?
I would ask him what constitutes excellence in his work. Having been conditioned for the High Art Club in my upbringing and in my own conservatory training, I really got inculcated with the single definition of excellence that my art form liked to crank down my throat, like making goose liver in me. And as I've spent decades now working in communities, recognizing multiple kinds of excellence, there's another really good document I recommend to your listeners. It's called Aesthetic Perspectives, also by Animating Democracy in the US. And they identify 11 different kinds of excellence. The traditional high arts is one of them, but there's 10 other kinds of excellence. And I would have wanted to have a deep conversation with Boal about the discriminating kinds of excellence in Theater of the Oppressed, because there's a deep knowing there. And with reading, I have a kind of feel for it, but I know there's deep understandings there I only have brushed up against.
So how do you think he would answer your question?
What's that?
How do you think he would answer your question?
He would say, he probably would say, okay, read all the books again and come back. But once it came back, he would be answering it about that liminal space between the art making and of of all people and the art form of theater. It would be in that zone where organic theatrical thinking meets form. There's something happening in there that he knew better than I ever discovered. And so I'd say, okay, I'll reread everything again, but then can we talk about this? And he would have said yes.
Thank you for that. So finally, is there anything else you'd like to say about your arts education practice?
Yes. Because my entry into Juilliard, you know, the mothership of the mainstream, highest achievement, they viewed what I was bringing in teaching artistry with huge condescension. You know, they were glad there were a few musicians with big hearts who liked kiddies. And there was a belief, you know, well, boy, those careers are going to go nowhere, until we discovered that, in fact, those careers actually went wider and fuller and were more lucrative than those who followed the tunnel track. So what I would want to add to our conversation is that the teaching artist perspectives I've been introducing into our conversation and that is around the field of teaching artistry makes the 21st century artist that we need. The 21st century artist who can achieve artistic excellence by the existing standards of the art form and can celebrate the other kinds of excellence which achieve different results. And those other results are the domain of the arts. We have not thought so. In the 20th century, there were some artists doing that stuff, but it was not thought that's where the arts belonged. And as the value proposition of the arts has to expand, if they're going to survive, at least in the US, we need artists who can not only do that kind of work, but actually who love the multiple kinds of excellence and being agents and catalysts of it, and then slipping back into the mainstream and then being inspired out to do a different kind of work that increases wellness in a community that's struggling. There's this gigantic power to the arts that has gotten so etiolated into the heavily funded streams. I want emerging artists to be invigorated by the breadth of their potential and the power that they bring to a wide array of purposes and not just the narrow purposes of institutional tradition.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your responses. They're hugely rich. I know that our listeners will enjoy them immensely. So I just want to finish off by saying thank you so much again for agreeing to do this with us.
It's my pleasure. So glad to share thoughts with you all.
For more podcasts in this series, go to portal.rcs.ac.uk/arts-educator-interviews.